Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, December 11th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, 24 locations across the greater Saratoga region, providing inpatient and outpatient health care to their community. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday are Dr. Larry Garbo and registered nurse Amy Zukalkowski of New York Oncology Hematology. They're here to discuss clinical research and how it can help you. We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in early, 1-800-348-2551. You heard me, 1-800-348-2551. Your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday are Dr. Larry Garbo and registered nurse Amy Zukalkowski of New York Oncology Hematology. Dr. Garbo is a board-certified medical oncologist and hematologist. In addition to seeing patients, he also chairs NYOH's research committee and oversees all Phase 1 general cancer and hematology clinical trials. Remember that, clinical trials. Amy is manager of clinical services at NYOH. Her role includes oversight of the region's largest clinical research operation with several dozen drug trials currently being offered to local cancer patients. Larry and Amy, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, put that in front of you, will you? Okay, great. So here we are, and I want to tell everybody why this is so important. As you all probably know, drugs are tested. Quite frequently, people have diseases, but there's nothing you can do about it. And along comes a drug that shows promise, and you enter into clinical trials. And if you're up the creek without a paddle, it might be good for you to get in on that clinical trial. Then you have to know how to get there. So this is really important because you'll know somebody. I had a very good friend who had cancer of the eye, and he went down to Washington, D.C., to the NIH. There was a clinical trial going on, but he couldn't get into it. So you can see that this could be a very important thing for you to know about, and I hope that you will. Okay, so, Larry, if I may call you that, my question is to you, tell us about the program.
So we have clinical trials available in 3 of our 7 sites. We offer trials.
Who are the 7 sites? I'm sorry.
Our 7 sites. We have 2 sites in Albany.
Yep.
1 in Troy, 1 in Clifton Park,
right.
Hudson, Amsterdam, and Rexford.
Wow. Okay. So you have these 7 sites, and you have clinical trials going on in all of them?
No, we only have clinical trials at our 3 largest sites, which are our site in Albany at Patroon Creek, our office within Albany Medical Center, and our office in Clifton Park.
Right. Okay, so how do people know about these trials?
Well, these trials are posted on our website. We talk about these.
Okay, stop right there. Give me the website. Amy.
It's NewYorkOncology.com.
Is it full spell out? Yeah, okay. NewYorkOncology.com. Okay, go ahead, Larry. I'm sorry.
Okay, so they're posted on the website. We also have research staff who will screen patients, and we have physicians, in addition to myself, who are very engaged as investigators and will discuss trials with patients when they appear to be appropriate candidates for enrollment to that particular trial.
Okay, just to get this off the table, much of this is paid for, right, by the drug companies?
Correct.
Yeah.
If it's a pharmaceutical-sponsored trial. We also have government funded through the NIH, so that would be paid for by federally funded
by
the government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that raises an interesting question for us, I guess, which is how often do these clinical trials pay off? In other words, we all know that there have been clinical trials on drugs that don't work. We've seen it with we've seen it time and again. For example, with Alzheimer's, I just read one that didn't work. So why should somebody get involved in one if you don't know that it'll work or think it'll work?
Well, for some patients, there may be limits to the standard therapies that are available. And in that case, enrolling in a clinical trial gives you a new treatment option. For other patients, some of the trials we have are not necessarily therapeutic trials. They're trials helping us to learn about new diagnostic tools. And in some cases, it may not be that there are no options available, but we're looking for better options than the ones available for a particular disease and disease status.
Do you guys have any idea what percentages of these trials work out? Amy? No. Okay. So Amy, what do you do?
I am a manager of clinical services, and I oversee research, lab, nursing for NYOH.
So you are a nurse. You're a registered nurse.
I am a registered nurse.
Okay. So you're sort of in charge of the way in which the whole thing operates on the ground, right?
Correct. We work as a team.
Yeah. And how hard is it to get into one of your programs, guys? I mean, the reason I say that is you fill up sometimes, right?
So all trials have a defined number of patients that are to be enrolled into that trial. And that's based on what the actuaries determine will be the adequate number of enrollees to prove the point that is trying to be made by the trial.
To prove it or not prove it.
Prove it or not prove it, exactly.
Yeah. And sometimes we all know that it gets proven, but then in greater life, as millions of people take it, the trials don't hold up.
Either the trial doesn't hold up, or sometimes we learn about new toxicities that weren't evident because of the small number of the relatively small number of the trial population.
Can you give us an example of one of those? Amy?
No? So Vioxx, if you remember Vioxx years ago. Came to market, and the data suggested that it was a COX-2 inhibitor for pain, and it showed to be promising. And then the drug came to market, and of course now commercially available to millions of people, as opposed to a phase 3 trial where you would maybe have 15 or 20,000 patients.
Yep.
And so obviously as you expand that population, you're going to see more side effects that you might not have seen during the clinical trials.
So Larry, do you ever get calls from friends or relatives who say, you know, my aunt really wants to be in this, but it's filled up. Can you get her in?
So more commonly, I'll get a call that my aunt has a cancer for which they're saying there is no good treatment.
Right.
Or she's not responding or tolerating to her treatment. What can you do for her? It's rare that I'll have somebody call about a specific trial and say, help me that way. Yeah. And if we have not met the accrual goal of the trial, then yes, we screen the patient. Once the trial has met the accrual goal, unless the sponsor is willing to extend that number, our hands are tied.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I am sure many of you have many questions. And I'm delighted to have this group on today because I think it really does give you an insight into something you might not know about. We'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
How many viruses are currently known to be the etiological agent of certain cancers?
Did you hear it, Larry, or shall we have him repeat it?
Could he repeat it?
Could you repeat it again, Jim?
How many viruses are currently known to be the etiological agent of certain cancers?
The answer is we don't know, right?
Well, I mean, there is some associated with the Epstein-Barr virus and Hodgkin's lymphoma, but other than that, I'm not aware of other specific viruses.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Here we are on the Medical Monday, live on the air. And if anybody wants to call me, don't do it now. Okay, so let's go to Fran in Gilderland. Fran in Gilderland, your turn.
Hi. I want to know if you have, excuse me, I've got a sore throat, I'm sorry. If you have any research going on looking at the link between family history and cancer. I come from a family where my mother, father, and sister, two sisters have had cancer, all of different kinds. And I'm the only one that has not been affected. I'm just wondering if there's any research going on within your practice about that kind of a link.
Fran, that's a very good question. And actually, through research, what we've seen is a lot of trials now that are identifying mutations that would be associated with certain cancers. So, for example, the BRCA gene that's associated with breast cancer and ovarian cancer. There's Lynch syndrome, which is a hereditary cancer. So we do have a genetics program outside of research where patients who are not diagnosed with cancer would come to get tested to see if they carry the gene. And then, of course, through our clinical research trials, a lot of the sponsors, the pharmaceutical companies or the NIH are actually looking at specific biomarkers for to identify how to treat those diseases.
But just to be perfectly clear, in answer to the question, we don't really, that's not usually a clinical trial that you guys do, right? You're more likely to test a drug.
Well, the pharmaceutical companies will, their protocol or what they're,
yes,
the question they're trying to answer, right? So
yes,
research is about answering an important clinical question.
And predicting.
And so sometimes the protocol will actually be looking at a smaller population. To your point earlier, it's a little bit more difficult to get on trials because they're narrowing the target population. And it might be looking to see if patients that have a specific gene mutation would respond to the treatment.
Okay, so let's just answer Fran's question real quickly. What would she do that you could offer her?
We have a program that evaluates hereditary risk for cancer patients. It's not a clinical trial, but it's an investigation into the potential risks associated in that family tree.
And Dr. Garbo, how would they find you in order to get into that one of those programs?
So to come in and be evaluated by our hereditary risk program, pick up the phone and call us.
And they would call you where?
My office is 518-489-0044.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. All right, we will take a short break. I'll be right back. Okay.
Support for WAMC comes from the University at Albany's Department of Biomedical Sciences, offering graduate research opportunities in biodefense and emerging infectious diseases, now accepting PhD and master's applications, albany.edu/BMS for more information. Nathan Latower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, announcing new primary care center on Main Street Fonda, now open, nlh.org. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Dr. Richard Halub with the Neurological Associates of Albany, conducting Alzheimer's research for over 25 years, currently conducting a research study for those with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 518-426-0575 for more information. And from Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs. In downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, AmherstCopy.com.
And we are back on the Vox Pop with Dr. Larry Garbo and registered nurse Amy Zukolkowski of New York Oncology Hematology. And you guys have a website. And on that website are all kinds of fascinating things, right?
Yes.
What do you do?
Well, on the website, we have a description of our practice. We have a description of our clinical research opportunities. We have a description of our hereditary risk program, which does genetic evaluation. We have a link to our foundation, which we use to help support our patients and families in need of additional support.
And can you sort of back up and give us signs of how do you get to your website? What do you write in?
NewYorkOncology.com.
NewYorkOncology.com. Okay, well, that's great. Let's go to Jim in Malta. 1-800-348-2551. Jim in Malta, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
3 years ago, I was diagnosed with superficial stage bladder cancer and had surgery, and everything was fine up until last spring, where I had my 6-month follow-up, and they found a new tumor, and that was removed by surgery or a scope. And I'm going back in 2 months for another follow-up. And I'm just curious, is there anything new for the treatment of bladder cancer? Because I was told that has a high recurrence rate.
So this sounds like you have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, which typically is treated by the urologists and not something
superficial stage.
Yeah, and not something that medical oncologists would be treating. There are new treatments, but they're really directed at invasive bladder cancer that we would have through our practice.
And what are the differences, please?
Non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is very superficial, just on the inside lining of the bladder wall. Muscle invasive is when the cancer is deeper and goes into the deeper tissues of the bladder.
I see. Now, if somebody like Jim has a question about whether there's a clinical trial for a drug that might be helpful to him, how would he go about that?
Well, again, our website and NewYorkOncology.com, and go to the link for our clinical research, or clinicaltrials.gov, which will give you a much broader look at clinical research that's available.
Okay, now the second one is very interesting, clinicaltrials.gov. And that, of course, is nationwide, right?
Correct.
And would you say that, so I guess I'm going to ask you the question that everybody asks you. Am I better off going to Boston and New York and not fooling around with you guys?
No. If we have a trial, all trials that we participate in are FDA regulated, and many are through the U.S. Oncology Network, but we also have government-sponsored trials as well.
Do you do any of your own? Just you guys, New York Hematology, Oncology.
In the very remote past, we've done a few, but we do not anymore.
So you are basically piggybacking, as everybody else does, on a national trial.
Correct.
Interesting. Okay. Anything interesting right now? We got some people on the phone, but I want to ask you, is there anything going on right now, a clinical trial that you're really very excited about?
Well, immunotherapy is, so if you think about treatments, there's chemotherapy, radiotherapy, which is radiation, surgery, hormone therapy, and through new trials, immunotherapy now is really emerging treatment. What would fall under that umbrella is CAR T-cell therapy or chimeric antigen receptor therapy, which is a very interesting treatment. It is actually taking patients' T-cells out of their body and re-engineering them with a protein that would essentially identify the cancer, and then you would reinfuse those cells back into the patient to treat the cancer. So again, it's using the body's own immune system to fight the cancer.
Okay, just to help us all out and follow through, now you've told us about the immunotherapy, but you're running clinical trials on immunotherapy?
We are, yes.
So how does that work?
Again, it would be specific to the disease, the type of cancer, and then again, meeting the eligibility criteria.
Larry? I thought you had something to add.
I do want to say, because you talked about Boston and Albany, and I think
sure.
It's important to to know about U.S. Oncology. So U.S. Oncology is a nationwide network that has over 400 practices, over 1,400 physicians. And through the partnership that NYOH has with U.S. Oncology, we are afforded the resources that allows us to offer novel treatments that you would otherwise only find at large academic or hospitals such as Boston or New York. So we have access to these trials in our own backyard.
Now, Amy, are you owned by U.S. Oncology?
We
are
not.
You're just associated.
We are associated. So a few years ago, we were one of the first in the area to offer an immunotherapy for lung cancer, which was very exciting.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, now let's go to Lawrence in Western Massachusetts. Okay, Lawrence, you're on.
Hey, can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, great. Yes, I was wondering if there are any studies comparing the cancer effects of all-natural cigarettes versus the not natural manufactured cigarettes, and I'm also wondering on which type of cigarettes are used for the studies, if there are no comparative studies.
I am not aware of any such studies. We certainly don't have any in our practice. Again, if you're interested, I would suggest going to clinicaltrials.gov.
And just writing in smoking?
Write in smoking, cigarettes, smoking cessation.
Because there was just a piece in, I guess, the Times, which compared, people who smoke with people who use the other stuff, the new stuff. So might be something to go look in the New York Times for, Lawrence. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Cindy in Queensbury. Okay, Cindy, your turn.
Yes, I was calling on the hereditary studies.
Yep.
The information that's gathered, can that be accessed, or would you hand over that information to a government agency or an insurance company?
That's a great question.
So there is the GINA law that protects insurance companies from obtaining genetic information for patients.
You mean protects or prohibits?
Protects the patient, prohibits us for sharing
Okay. Right.
information. Mm-hmm. Thank you for clarifying. And specifically in clinical research, when you sign an informed consent, which is a process where patients are notified of all of the benefits, the risks, the purpose of the trial, in there it specifically talks about the GINA law and the protection.
Okay, Cindy?
Okay.
Okay for you?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, now the decks are cleared. You want to get in. You want to be on the radio. You want to ask a question that you've always wanted, that you're going to kick yourself at 12 o'clock at night because you can't, because, you know, the program isn't on there. Now's the time. Don't be a procrastinator. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And we have heard by email from Doug in Mayfield. My understanding is that alcohol dilates blood vessels, but it is also bad for blood pressure. Please help me understand the seeming contradiction. Now, it may be a little bit off the topic that we're on right now, but do either of you want to check in on that one? Do you want to hear it again? No. You want to hear the question again? No. The question is, alcohol dilates blood vessels, but it's also bad for high blood pressure. Please help me understand the seeming contradiction. And I think by alcohol, I think he means, schnapps.
No. So we definitely would not say to consume alcohol because it would reduce your blood pressure.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll go now to Katie in Woodburn. All right, Katie, you're on. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Hello, Katie, you're on.
Good afternoon. So I have more of a remark than a question. When someone asked, would you recommend we go to Boston or the city? As a parent who had a child at 16 years old diagnosed with stage 3 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, what does everybody think right away? They think, oh, my goodness, St. Jude's, I've got to go somewhere like that where the top-of-the-line treatments are. And I'd also like to add, I had just lost my health insurance coverage for the family and had recently enrolled in the New York State Medicaid. So I was scared on two fronts. Are we going to get the best treatment? Where can we go? I want to tell you, we went to Westchester Maria Ferrara Children's Hospital. Local doctors, they assured us, and they were correct, they share all the same protocols. that any of the St. Jude's or the big research hospitals share, but Westchester is also a teaching hospital, I'm sure you're aware. We were treated as if we had the top-of-the-line insurance and just pulled up in a Rolls Royce. My son was cured. They do fabulous work. And anybody who has those kinds of doubts about the protocols, like the doctor was saying, I think that's pretty much standard fare now. You guys all share, and gals, the info with one another. Why
okay,
wouldn't
okay.
you, right?
Whoa, Katie. Okay, I'm the moderator. You're asking a very good question. I'm going to go to Larry. Larry.
So
thank you.
We certainly do share information. That's one of the big benefits of being part of the U.S. Oncology Network, because we have a very rapidly available network of over 1,400 physicians to share things. We also obviously attend CME, continuing medical education events, to learn about the newest research and developments that are occurring both inside our practice and outside of our practice. Not all treatment is 100% standard, although in the pediatric age group, and at age 16, I'm not sure if your child was treated on a pediatric or an adult protocol, but the pediatric cancer care is almost uniformly identical across the country.
Now, aren't there some places that are trying out new stuff that nobody else does?
Well, a trial that I have may not be available at Sloan Kettering or in Dana-Farber in Boston, and at the same time, a trial they have may not be available to me. So different institutions will have different trials.
Okay, thank you for that. And now one other question before we get to some of these other very good calls from John and Catherine and Mary. And that is, Larry, do you find that people understand that there are different levels of tests? So there's level one, level two, level three. Am I wrong about that?
You mean different levels of clinical trials?
Yes.
Jesus.
Yeah, so there are four phases to clinical trials. Phase one is looking at a new drug that is just being introduced into man, looking for safety, toxicity, and drug dosing limits. Phase two is looking to see in what tumors there may be efficacy, and also evaluating further those safety and drug dosing limits. In phase three, we put that drug or drug combination up against more standard therapies to see if they are more effective, equally effective, or less effective than what we already have known as standard therapy, that standard therapy having become standard therapy by prior clinical trials. And phase four is aftermarket research, where we're basically collecting data to help see if there are indeed unusual toxicities or even better successes than previously reported.
That was great. Thank you, Larry. So I guess I want to go now to John in Del Mar. All right, John in Del Mar, you're on. Hey, John. Uh-oh. I thought that... Oh, I see what I did wrong. John in Del Mar, you there?
Yeah, I am.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
I was recently diagnosed with bladder cancer and had a biopsy, which they then proceeded to do a resection and scrape it out, and they've put me into a BCG program, and that seems to be going well, but the idea is to go back in after a 6-week treatment and look at it again. Now, when I was in the hospital at one point, one doctor came in, he was all doom and gloom, and my primary oncologist really felt that the guy was off the mark, and that what he was seeing in scans was just swelling due to the surgery. I mean, I didn't go get a second opinion. Should I be getting a second opinion as a matter of course? Or should I, would the BCG treatment hold everything at bay till we went in and took another look?
So if your cancer is non-invasive, then BCG treatment is the current standard of care. And ongoing reevaluation by your treating physicians would be the appropriate thing to do. A second opinion is something that I always encourage my patients to do if they or their family feel the need to do so. I also will refer them for second opinions if I feel that someone else may have a better treatment option than I may have for them.
John, thank you.
Well, it seemed that the BCG was like a cutting-edge program. Is it, or is it kind of...
BCG is the current standard of care.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, John. Okay. And now on to Mary in Beacon. All right, Mary in Beacon, you're on.
Hi. I'm not sure I have a question other than where is the newer treatments for metabolic, like 3-bromopyruvate? There was a Dr. Seifert who did a book from Boston College or University. I'm a little unclear about this. He wrote a book that was extremely well received, and then it dropped out of sight. And I'm just wondering if 3-bromopyruvate has been not used or somehow discredited. I have a friend who has a very serious, unusual sarcoma. It's called the ossifying fibromyxoid sarcoma, and it was the tissue that wrapped around the bone. He eventually was he had to have an amputation of that area, but it didn't go into the bone until there was treatment. And I haven't heard of anything that's out there for something, a sarcoma like that.
Okay, Mary, hold on, Mary. Dr. Amy, anything?
So we currently do not have any trials, but again, I would ask that you go to clinicaltrials.gov. There are search terms where you can put in the diagnosis. You could also put in the agent that you're looking for. And if there is a clinical trial out there, if you scroll all the way to the bottom, once you click on the study, it will tell you the locations that that study is being offered.
Thank you, Mary. All right, we're going to take a break. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back with Catherine and Jeff and your calls, 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Act Smart New York, Saratoga Springs, offering individualized outpatient counseling and Suboxone treatment for opioid use disorder and medical treatment for alcohol problems. ActSmartNewYork.com. Villa Veritas Foundation for Hongson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center providing healing focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addictions. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Vascular Health Partners, Drs. Manish Mehta, Philip Patty, and Zachary Castan, offering personal, comprehensive, minimally invasive endovascular and vascular surgical care in 3 locations, Latham, Amsterdam, and Queensbury. VascularHealthPartners.com. And from Saratoga Hospital, the multi-specialty practice of Saratoga Hospital, with 27 specialty practices and more than 170 providers. Taking care of their community, SaratogaHospital.org to learn more.
And we are rounding the horn right here with Dr. Larry Garbo and registered nurse Amy Zukolkowski of New York Oncology Hematology. Again, Larry and Amy, the website, you want to get to you guys, what's the website?
NewYorkOncology.com.
NewYorkOncology.com. New York is spelled out.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're going to go now to Catherine in Salisbury. Okay, Catherine, your turn. You're on.
Okay. Hello. Thank you. And thank all of you. It's a very good program. I am a breast cancer survivor that occurred. Diagnosis was 16 years ago. After about two and a half years of surgeries, CMF, chemo, it was a small tumor, but I was treated conservatively, radiation. And then that was when Arimidex was being approved rather than tamoxifen. So I was started, one of the first patients after the approval, I was on Arimidex for 5 years and was very grateful, by the way, for the wonderful oncological care throughout my treatment. Actually, both in Boston and locally in Connecticut. I was asked at the end of the 5 years, and I was looking forward to doing something to give back. I was very grateful for my life and wanted to agree to continue the Arimidex for 5 more years. and I took home a huge packet of information and so on. I decided against it because I this was pre-Affordable Care Act. It was also pre-Medicare for me. And I had experienced a lot of side effects and so on from the Arimidex. And very, very clearly, my insurance, which was a huge premium, it was over $1,000 and a huge deductible. At that time, it was going to be very expensive for
Catherine,
me.
Catherine, let me cut you off a little bit because we have about 11 other people on, behind you on the air. So Amy, Larry, any reaction to this?
So may I ask for clarification, the extension of the Arimidex, was it actually a clinical trial or were you asked off of a clinical trial to continue the therapy?
It was a trial, a new trial, to see if a five-year extension would have efficacy.
Okay.
And I wanted to do it. I couldn't afford to do it, and I had expressed that, and the hospital that was sponsoring it was not helpful in offering me care with side effects.
Now, Amy, you used to work for the drug companies, right, for pharma?
Yes.
I'm maybe somewhat naively, I've always thought that if you were going to be in a trial, you were going to get the drugs for free, but apparently not.
Well, it depends. So,
well, this wasn't for the drug. I'm sorry. This was not for the drug. This was for actual additional Medicare that I might need, any side effects and so on, which I had experienced.
Okay, Amy.
So, you know, I can't comment on the specific trial because I don't have the specifics. But what I will say is that sometimes, specifically the government-run trials, will not cover certain expenses. That's something that we do review with patients prior throughout the informed consent process and prior to them consenting. But primarily, when a pharmaceutical company does provide sponsorship for the trial, if it is not standard of care, they will cover the cost.
Good call. Thank you very much for that. Okay, so now we're trying to hurry up and get done before the end of the program. We'll go to Jeff in Albany. Jeff, you've got an interesting question.
Hello. Hello. I was wondering, Alan?
Yes. We're here, Jeff.
This is Jeff.
Yeah, we know. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, these studies are partially funded through tax dollars, correct?
Sometimes not.
Oh, not all the time?
I don't believe so. Amy?
No. Pharmaceutical-sponsored or industry-sponsored trials are covered by the sponsor or the company that has identified the molecule and looking to study the drug in the diseases.
Nevertheless, okay. Jeff's question is a good one in that there are times that the government is sponsored.
Hey, Jeff. Funded by tax dollars, when they go to development, they're made by pharmaceutical companies. Who gets the majority of the profits and who pays back the tax dollars?
So I don't know the specifics. I will say that typically when there are NIH trials, there are collaborations. So you may have the National Institute of Health that's collaborating with a pharmaceutical company to try and offset some of the costs.
Yes, but Jeff asked an interesting question, I do think. And that is that basic science is often done by the federal government. And then companies, various health providers, pharma, come around and they create the drug and then they sell the drug and they make the profits. And they are living, of course, off the work of the original work of the basic science that is being done by the federal government. But that's the way it's set up, right?
Well, it costs approximately $1 million a day to run a clinical trial. So at the end of the day, drug prices the profits need to be shared with pharmacies, with insurance companies, with, the manufacturer. So, it's a very sensitive topic.
Jeff, as always, thank you. Okay, let's now go to, it is a sensitive topic. Now let's go to Greg in Kingston. Greg in Kingston, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a 75-year-old male. I was diagnosed with bladder cancer 3 years ago in August. The tumor was removed.
Bladder.
The biopsy came back, and it was highly aggressive. I got the six-week BCG treatment, a year later, in the following August, I was again diagnosed with a recurrence. That tumor was removed. The biopsy came back moderately aggressive. This past August, diagnosed with an additional tumor. Tumor was removed, and I was diagnosed with a tumor that was benign. My question is, due to the removals and the lessening of the severity of the diagnosis, does this mean I have a good prognosis, or am I just doomed every couple of years to have another operation?
So it's not uncommon when you have non-invasive bladder cancer to have local recurrences in the bladder. It sounds like there's a favorable change in your disease each time they check it, but you still need to be clinically monitored for recurrent disease. But it sounds like you're going in the right direction.
And your opinion from your experience, going in the right direction, does this mean that it's getting less of a problem, or that in fact it's going to continue to be the same problem on an ongoing basis?
And a very short answer, because we've got a lot of other people there, Lauren.
So it would seem that it's improving. You need ongoing evaluation by your urologist, and I have no more to say.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, and therefore, we're now going to go to Ron is in Esopus, everybody down by the creek. Go ahead, Ron, you're on.
Hi there, thank you. Good show.
Thanks.
First of all, does everybody know about angel flights? These are pilots, private pilots, that will take you to hospitals that are far away for free to get your treatments. It's an amazing thing.
Who wants to comment?
I've heard of angel flights. I've had no direct involvement with any of them.
I did. It was great. It was great.
What did you have? What did you have?
My wife had leiomyosarcoma that started in a fibroid. And I guess it's pretty rare. I wonder if there's any treatment that trials have come up with that's effective against it.
Specifically for uterine leiomyosarcoma, I don't have any active trials now. There certainly are trials evaluating treatments for leiomyosarcoma, whether they are of uterine origin or origin in other organs. And again,
right,
to explore that, clinicaltrials.gov.
So clinicaltrials.gov,
okay.
You find a clinical trial.
Wait.
You find a clinical trial. Yep. Let's say it's in California, and you're here in Albany. The angel flights aren't going to fly you back and forth while all of this stuff happens. What do you do?
Well, if there's no trial that is in close proximity to you, then you try to come up with something on the order of an angel flight, or if you have the resources to go. Otherwise, you may be able to work with an institution and possibly have that institution
administer.
That institution would have to come online with that trial. You can't just participate in a trial unless you're part of the documentation for the trial.
Thank you, Ron in Esopus. Okay, now we're going to go to Greg in Schenectady. Greg in Schenectady on line number 4. Go, Greg.
Hello, yes. I, at the age of 55, contracted non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a follicular small cell. After 5 years, it mutated to an aggressive form, after which I had a stem cell transplant at Dana-Farber. It's now 15 years later, so I'm 75. I've been monitoring, initially I was with New York Oncology, Dr. Hillinger, who's since retired, every 3 months, then every 6 months, then every 12 months, then every 18 months, and now at 2 years. But because Dr. Hillinger retired, I've been working with my primary care. Should I continue that treatment is one question. What is the probability of a reoccurrence after 15 years of remission? And third, if I came out of remission, what is the typical treatment today? Is it another stem cell transplant, or is other options available?
Okay, Greg, we're going to have to get this answered as quickly as possible because we have a lot of people standing by. Okay. Larry.
So very quickly, one, you're not being treated now. You're just being observed. You do need ongoing observation. 15 years out, high likelihood that your disease is behind you. And three, if your disease were to come back, it would depend on exactly what it was. Has it again changed? So can't really talk about specific treatment.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, and now on to, let's see here. Oh, yeah, Dan in North Adams. Dan in North Adams, you're on.
Hi, thank you. Do they have any kind of a list or a data bank where it tells you how good or bad something is for the liver? I see a lot of warnings on over-the-counter medications and things, and they all say they're bad for the liver, but is there anything where you can determine how bad so you can shop more wisely for these things?
That's a very interesting question. The reason I like your question so much, Dan, is that, you know, you watch television in the middle of the night and then some drug comes on and then they tell you obligatorily the 10,000 things that might be wrong with that drug. And it makes you very nervous and you say, well, why would anybody take that drug if there are 11 things that they're telling you to watch out for?
Yeah, that usually makes up my mind about it right there.
Okay, Doctor, Larry?
So I don't know specifically of a list that ranks the toxicity and tells you. What they're telling you is that in their available data from clinical trials, they have seen this type of toxicity that may occur. The key word here is may.
Okay. Anything else on that, Dan?
Yeah, we need more information. We need to be able to tell, you know, I don't want to mention any brand names, but be able to tell how good or bad something is, how it ranks. You know, if somebody could put that information out there, you know, in a data bank or something, I think it would help a lot of people who have to maintain strict liver health.
Amy, did you have something?
Well, I'm just in regards to drugs, the FDA is very stringent on, you know, approving. There's a data safety monitoring committee through clinical trials where they are continuously looking at the data to make sure that it's providing more benefit than risk.
And yet Dan asked a very interesting question, which is it offered, are their results offered so that the common Joe can basically access it and find out a little bit more? In other words, is it easily digestible?
So if a drug is suspected to have liver toxicity, that might be, when you look at the eligibility criteria, someone with liver disease or someone with abnormal liver lab values may be actually excluded from the trial to maintain your safety.
Okay, thanks, Dan. And we'll go to Jack in Monticello, but not before I tell you we could probably take one more telephone call in addition to Jack. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And off to Jack in Monticello. Jack, you're on.
Yes, I had a right thyroidectomy in 2000, secondary to a lump. I've been stabilized on 75 micrograms of level thyroxine for the last 17 years. Low-functioning left thyroid. Could I stop? And perhaps if I get symptoms, then go back to the doctor and get retested and start again with the level thyroxine, or should I just maintain with what I have?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you gave me a good history. I don't know your whole history. I'm not here to render opinion. This is something that you should discuss with your treating physician.
Yes, but it's an interesting question about the thyroxine for those of us who are on it. And the question is, once you take it, are you taking it for the rest of your life?
That depends on your metabolism, and people will require dose adjustments depending on other medications at times. But again, this is something that needs to be discussed with your personal provider, not something that I can answer on this in this forum.
Thank you, Jack. And we'll go to Barbara in Boston Lake. Barbara, it's going to have to be fast, real fast. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, real fast, Barbara.
I have breast cancer. I'm with New York Oncology. I'm in radiation. I'm possibly facing, because I'm hormone receptive, tamoxifen or something. Is that really the path that one needs to go after radiation.
So depending on the specifics of your disease, that should be discussed with your oncologist, but that certainly sounds appropriate.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. And so very quickly, we've got a Kara in Latham. Kara, it's got to be quick or not at all. Go ahead.
Real quick, I'm hoping that this will help somebody. My husband was involved in a clinical trial at Mayo Clinic. Our CPA told us that all of my expenses for accompanying him, because he couldn't go alone, were tax deductible. And on top of that, a very kind airline eventually gave me complimentary airfare with him as a companion for a whole year.
That's great. Okay, anybody want to react to that? No. Thank you very much. Okay, we are out of time. My apologies to no one because no one was left on the line. That's always great. I want to thank Dr. Larry Garbo and registered nurse Amy Zukilkowski of New York Oncology Hematology for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals. Members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to the great Dina Salzman for answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.